Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, we're going to provide an update on the court's current term, followed by a review of some of the most interesting cases the court heard earlier in the term that we're still waiting on opinions from, then a summary of the cases argued in the first week of the court's January oral arguments, and a quick preview of a few cases coming up later in the term. But first, a quick word about some changes to the format that we're trying out. We've launched a series of YouTube live streams. We're going to try to broadcast these on a regular weekly basis, and at least for now, we'll be live on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. In these weekly live streams, we hope to cover the most recent opinions, upcoming arguments, and other news about the court on a timely basis. But most importantly, if you join us during the live broadcast, you can ask your own questions in the live chat, and I'll do my best to answer them live on the air. The remainder of this podcast episode consists of audio from the first live stream in this series, which aired on Thursday, January 4th. As of this recording, the next scheduled live stream will be on Thursday, January 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern. But if you're listening after January 11th, please check the Counting to Five YouTube channel to find the next scheduled live stream. We plan to release the audio from future live streams as episodes of this podcast, but we also plan to continue to publish additional podcast-exclusive episodes with interviews and other content. As always, I'm eager to hear your feedback. And now, the January 4th live stream.
Hello, I'm Mike. I'm the host of the Counting to Five Supreme Court podcast. Counting to Five, if you're not familiar with it, is a podcast that seeks to cover the Supreme Court in a way that's accessible to lawyers and non-lawyers alike without sacrificing legal accuracy. This fall, we did one YouTube live stream as kind of an experiment, and we liked how it came out. So I'm starting tonight. We're going to try and make this a fairly regular series of YouTube live streams. Tonight's was not publicized ahead of time, so it's just going to be me talking. But in future live streams, I'm hoping that viewing audience can submit questions about the cases I'm discussing about the court, and I'll answer them live on the live stream. The next live stream will be next week. That's Thursday, January 11th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're watching this after that date, please check the Counting to Five YouTube page to see when our next scheduled live stream is. This live stream, I guess the agenda for today is to talk about the state of the term. It's early January, and the Supreme Court's term, which started in October, is now about 3 months in. So we're going to talk about what the court has done so far and where we stand right now. Talk about some of the cases that the court has already heard that we're waiting for opinions in, and then we'll go on to talk about the cases that the court is going to hear next week. Starting on next Monday, the court will be hearing, beginning its January oral argument session. So we'll talk about the first week of January's cases, and then I'll talk about some of the other highly anticipated cases coming up later in the term. So without further ado, I'll get started. The big question that people have been asking right now about the current Supreme Court term is, where are the opinions? As I mentioned, we're 3 months in, and right now the court has only issued one single opinion in an argued case. That was a case called Hamer versus Neighborhood Housing Services of Chicago. It was a very technical procedural case about the effects of missing a time deadline for filing an appeal. It's not really a case that was getting much attention. Usually by this time in the term, by the end of December, the court has issued several opinions. In the last five terms, they've issued between three and six opinions by the end of December. And actually, this year is on track to be the slowest start to a Supreme Court term since 1868, when the second opinion of the year was not issued until January 11th. Next week, when they begin their January oral arguments, it's very likely that the court will issue some more opinions. So we'll start to see some of those fall cases get decided. We don't know yet. The court has not yet announced if it is expecting to issue opinions next week. So why is this happening? It's a little odd because the court has a relatively light term. They only heard 25 cases from October through December, which is fairly light by historical standards. So you'd think that would give them more time on finishing up opinions. But part of the reason may be that this is just a term with a lot of very controversial cases. Last term, which was marked by the majority of the term, the court only had 8 members after the death of Justice Scalia the previous year. And the term was widely considered to be a very dull term by most Supreme Court watchers. This year is anything but. This year, the court's docket is filled with cases that are both a number of high-profile cases that have been getting a lot of media coverage, and also a number of cases that are just expected, based on past history, expected to closely divide the justices on the court, often along the stereotypical conservative liberal lines. And the October argument session started right off with a number of very contentious cases. It started with a case called Epic Systems v. Lewis, which was actually 3 consolidated cases, which were about the enforceability of arbitration provisions in employment agreements. And that is very closely watched, especially by labor and employment lawyers. And there were 2 immigration-related cases that the court heard that were carried over from last term. Now, these cases were not were argued last term, but the court was unable to issue a decision by the end of the term. And usually that means that the court was internally divided, either 4-4 because they only had 8 members at the time the case was argued, or divided in some other way that they were unable to put together a 5-member majority. So they had the cases re-argued. So however those cases come out, they're expected to be fairly closely divided, given the fact that, you know, an 8-member court was unable to reach a majority. That's Sessions v. DiMaia, which was about a challenge to provisions to remove immigrants who have been convicted of a crime that was challenged as unconstitutionally vague. And then there was Jennings v. Rodriguez, which was about immigration detainees and whether they are entitled to a bond hearing to be released pending a determination of their whether they're going to be removed from the country. Then the court heard Gill v. Whitford. That was a Wisconsin case that was challenging under the Constitution, challenging partisan political gerrymanders and asking the court to find that Wisconsin had gone too far in drawing political boundaries, electoral boundaries on partisan lines to give a large advantage to, in that case, the Republican Party. And that's a case that's gotten a lot of attention and has been kind of a high-profile case. And the court had a few other cases that it heard in October, also some, you know, fairly interesting criminal cases, case about whether corporations can be found liable under international human rights law under a law called the Alien Tort Statute. So there's these cases, not all of them were super high profile, but there were no obvious slam dunk easy cases. So it won't be too surprising if there's a lot of 5-4, 6-3, or other closely divided opinions coming out of October. And that would explain to some degree why the court has been so slow in issuing opinions. Typically, unanimous opinions tend to come out quicker, and the early part of the court's the early part of the term sees a lot more unanimous decisions, just because when there's less disagreement on the court, there's less back and forth between the justices in coming to a final opinion before it's issued. Where when a court is closely divided and there may be multiple concurrences or dissents from the majority opinion, there may be a lot more back and forth as the different opinions respond to each other, and it might take a while to get in a more final form. So it may just be the high number of very contentious cases early in the term has slowed down the court in getting any opinions out. But hopefully we'll see some opinions soon, and that'll get the ball rolling and maybe give us some insight into what was taking so long. In addition to, so the other thing that's interesting to look at is the court's caseload this term. So just to really quickly describe kind of the shape of the court's term, the court's term runs each year from October basically through the end of June. In the court hears oral arguments for 2 weeks a month from October through April, so for 7 months. And then it typically issues all of its opinions for the cases argued that term, except when something is carried over and re-argued like the cases I mentioned earlier. But typically all of the opinions for the term will be issued by the end of June. And then the court goes into a summer recess, returning shortly before the next October. Now, the petitions that the court receives, petitions from parties that lost in lower courts, and the court receives these petitions year-round, and they grant the petitions, that is, choosing to accept particular cases to be heard, on a rolling basis throughout the whole year. So, once they've accepted a case, there's usually several months between when the case is accepted and when it's argued, and that's to give time for the briefing so the parties can submit their legal briefs. And typically the full normal briefing schedule takes about 3.5 months, so the court would like to leave at least that much time between a grant of a petition and the oral argument. But if necessary to fill their calendar, they can shorten that time and give the parties less time to finish their briefs. But basically what happens is by the end of June, when the court wraps up for the year and goes on their summer recess, the cases, they've typically granted enough cases by the end of June to fill out the fall arguments calendar for October, November, December. And then when the court returns just before the beginning of October, throughout the beginning of the term, they will gradually grant more cases. Those new cases that get granted get slotted into the argument calendars later in the term, basically starting in January, and then filling out January, February, March as the term progresses. And typically by sometime in January, the court's April calendar, which is the last month of oral arguments, fills up. And then from that point forward, from sometime in January forward, every new case that's granted is for the following term. So those will be heard starting the following October. Now, over the past couple decades, there has been a very substantial decline in the court's caseload, the number of cases that it hears in a given year. In the 1980s, the court routinely heard more than 150 cases a year. But in the late 1980s or early 90s, there was a pretty rapid decline, and this number went from, 150 or so down to 80 to 90 cases a year. That declined further into the 2000s to 70 to 80 cases a year. And in the last few years, there have been several years that have been even significantly lower, even in the low 60s. And this year is shaping up to look like it could be another very low year. They started the year in October, when they came back in October, with a fairly low number of cases left over that had been granted before they left in June. And here's how it looks so far. They heard 9 cases in October, 6 in November, and 10 in December. They have 9 cases on their calendar for January that's starting next week, and then another 9 cases on the calendar for February, and 9 more cases that have not been scheduled yet that will likely go on the calendar for March. If you add that up, that's 52 cases total that they've granted so far. Now, those numbers are low because the court, in a typical month, where they have oral argument, they hear argument for 2 weeks, but only 3 days a week. And the court likes to, hear 2 arguments a day on those argument dates. So, in a typical month, they have basically 12 argument slots. In some months where there's a holiday or something, they may lose a day and there may only be 10 slots. But usually, 10 or 12 argument slots per month. And basically none of the calendars, this year, none of the months have been full. They've all had, empty argument slots where they could have easily fit, other cases without having to add extra arguments beyond the 2 that they like to hear in a day. So what's left? Well, if the 9 cases that aren't yet scheduled are put on the calendar for March, that still leaves April's calendar open. The court, has its next scheduled conference tomorrow. That's Friday, January 5th. And then the next 2 weeks after that, on the 12th and the 19th, they have conferences where they will discuss petitions and have the opportunity to grant some more cases. And basically after January, any petitions after that are basically too late to make it onto this year's calendar. They would be too time constrained to have, a reasonable briefing schedule. So basically in the next few weeks, we'll see how the end of the year fills out. Now, even if they filled their entire, April calendar with 12 cases, that would only be 64 for the whole year, which is, pretty low. And over the last decade or so, they've only averaged about 9 cases granted in the month of January. So this is looking to be a relatively, a very, very light year. One other thing to keep in mind is that, because the cases that don't make it onto the April calendar are carried over to the next year, the more cases that the court tries to kind of hurry up and get on the calendar for April, those are cases that are potentially not going to be carried over to the following year, which, will leave them again in the next October with a light number of cases at the start of the term and just kind of perpetuate this whole, light, caseload. So this is just it's an interesting trend to keep an eye on, and it's it'll be interesting to see whether, the court, makes any changes or any real effort to increase the number of cases that they're granting each year, or whether this is just a new normal of very low caseloads at the court. So in addition to the October cases that I mentioned briefly earlier, the court's heard several other kind of very highly anticipated cases. These are cases that the court already heard argument on earlier this term that we're just waiting for opinions on. And I'll just briefly describe a few of these. One of them is Oil States Energy Services LLC v. Greens Energy Group. And this is a challenge to the constitutionality of a relatively new administrative procedure for challenging the validity of patents. And this is a very closely watched case by the patent bar. This new process called inter partes review has been responsible for the invalidation of quite a few patents, and this challenge, which argues that the entire process is unconstitutional because it doesn't involve the courts, change and undo that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Another case that's gotten a lot of attention is Carpenter v. United States. And this is a Fourth Amendment case about whether the government can track a person's cell phone by obtaining from the cell provider the cell tower location data without getting a warrant. And this is being very closely watched by, Fourth Amendment and, you know, criminal procedure and, attorneys. And it's being described, by some people as potentially, the most important Fourth Amendment case that the court has heard in many years. And the case, may cause the court to revisit a rule known as the third party doctrine, which says that when a person voluntarily gives up information to a third party, they surrender any expectation of privacy in it, which basically removes their Fourth Amendment protection. Here, the argument from the government is that, basically the, cell phone user is voluntarily providing their location to the cell phone provider in order for that provider to be able to give them cell coverage on their cell network. And by doing so, they basically have, you know, relinquished any expectation of privacy in that location data. And so they have no, you know, right to challenge that. And that has potentially, you know, very broad implication on all sorts of data that people have, you know, both, you know, in relation to their cell phone, but also all sorts of, cloud storage type information and other, you know, network information that is kept by some third party. So that's definitely, one to watch. Another interesting case, is called, Christie v. National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA. And this is a challenge to a New Jersey law that removes New Jersey's prohibition on certain types of sports betting. And the argument is that this violates a federal law, which was intended to stop states from authorizing sports betting. And basically, it's a case that turns on whether New Jersey's law is preempted by that federal law, so it's invalid because it's in conflict with this federal law, or whether the way that the federal law is written, the federal government is unconstitutionally commandeering New Jersey and forcing New Jersey to carry out federal policy rather than the federal government enforcing its own policy. So that's an interesting federalism case that the court heard. And finally, this is probably the highest profile case of the term, the one that's getting the most public attention because it kind of fits into culture war type narrative, is the case called Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And this is a case about a baker in Colorado who refused to bake a custom wedding cake for a same-sex wedding ceremony, and was an action was brought by the under Colorado's public accommodations laws, and Colorado's laws, anti-discrimination laws, treat sexual orientation as a protected classification. And the baker was found to be in violation of Colorado's law. And the way this case has been framed, it's been brought as a First Amendment compelled speech case. And the argument is that the baker is being forced to create an artistic expression or message that he disagrees with. And so this is a case that basically pits anti-discrimination law against the First Amendment's protection against compelled speech. And that's definitely a case to watch because it presents some very interesting and potentially tricky line drawing questions that the court may or may not answer. Basically determine, you know, whichever way the court comes down, to what degree its decision may cut into, the effect of anti-discrimination law, or on the other hand, may, you know, restrict the protection that the First Amendment provides to certain types of to the protection against being compelled to engage in certain, you know, potentially artistic forms of expression. So those are a few of the highest profile cases, most interesting cases that the court has already heard. And again, decisions could come down on them at any time. Again, the more contentious cases tend to take longer, and more of the highly contentious, real hot button cases tend to be backloaded toward the later part of the term. But again, there's no telling; we could see them anytime. So next, I'm going to turn to the January oral arguments, which start on next week, Monday, January 8th. And I'm just going to run through each of the cases that's going to be heard next week and kind of give a quick little description about what these cases are about. And this time the different argument days next week are kind of themed. The court sometimes does this when they have multiple cases that are related to a similar subject matter or address similar issues. The court often will group them together on the same argument day, and they've done that here next week. So on Monday, January 8th, the court has two interstate disputes. These are actions brought by one state directly against another state. And these cases are interesting because they're kind of procedurally interesting because the Constitution gives the Supreme Court what's called original jurisdiction over cases between two states. And this means the cases are brought as an original matter directly in the Supreme Court rather than being brought in some lower state or federal court and then later appealed up to the Supreme Court. So they're brought directly in the Supreme Court right from the start. Now, the Supreme Court is not a trial court. It's an appellate court. It is used to reviewing the opinions issued by lower courts, and it's really not situated to conduct its own trials. So what the Supreme Court does in these original jurisdiction cases is it appoints someone called a special master to hear the case. It's some outside person. Sometimes it's a law professor with expertise in the particular area. And this person is appointed and they essentially act like a trial judge in the case. And they kind of operate over on the side, conducting the litigation between the different states. And then instead of issuing an opinion like an actual judge would, they issue a report. And the report is basically their recommended opinion in the case. After these reports are filed, the parties can file what's known as exceptions to the reports. And the terminology is they say they accepted to the report. These exceptions are basically their disagreements or, you know, arguments why the report is wrong or shouldn't be followed by the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court then considers these exceptions, and this is basically the Supreme Court's way of converting these original jurisdiction cases into something that's more like an appeal. So it's kind of more like the parties are appealing from the special master's determination. And these cases are not that rare. There's, you know, maybe one or so on average, one of these cases every year. A lot of them are water disputes. It's a very common source of litigation between different states is disputes over water rights on various rivers that either border or pass through multiple states. And again, these are not usually cases with a lot of broad importance, and they're not things that get a lot of attention. They are often very significant to the states involved and may involve, you know, very important water rights or, you know, payments between states in many millions of dollars over water usage. But, you know, not the most wide-reaching cases you might see. So on Monday next week, the court has two of these cases. The first one is called Texas v. New Mexico and Colorado. And this is a case about the Rio Grande and the water rights under the Rio Grande Compact of 1938, which establishes the rights of Texas, New Mexico, and Colorado to certain use of water from the Rio Grande. And this action was brought by Texas against New Mexico, accusing New Mexico of using water from the river that it's not entitled to. But the specific issue the court's looking at is the United States wants to intervene in the lawsuit. They want to come in as a party to the lawsuit on Texas's side against New Mexico. And part of the argument is that the U.S. has a treaty with Mexico related to the water rights in the Rio Grande, and the actions of these states implicate, you know, the United States' ability to uphold its end of the treaty with Mexico. And the special master issued a report recommending that some of the United States' claims should be dismissed because they're based on this 1938 compact, and the United States is not a party to that compact. But the United States has accepted to this recommendation, that is, you know, basically disagreed with it and is asking the Supreme Court to decide the issue. And the second case on Monday is Florida v. Georgia. This is a case about the allocation of water in the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River Basin, which covers parts of Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. And those three states have been unable to come to a agreement about the allocation of the water in the river system. So the water allocation has basically been managed by the Army Corps of Engineers, which operates a set of dams and reservoirs on the river system. And this particular dispute is about Lake Lanier, a reservoir in Georgia, which is created by a dam on the Chattahoochee River. And a substantial portion of the water in this lake supplies the Atlanta metropolitan area. So this action was brought by Florida against Georgia, alleging that Georgia's overuse of water from the river system is causing ecological and economic harm to Florida. Excuse me. The special master issued a report and basically recommended that Florida's claim should be denied because the Army Corps of Engineers is not a party to the case, and without the court directing the Army Corps of Engineers to take certain actions, Florida can't show that by capping Georgia's water use, Florida's harms would actually be remedied, because the effect of capping Georgia's water use on Florida would depend heavily on, you know, exactly what the Army Corps of Engineers chose to do with the additional water in the river system. So Florida has made an exception to that master's report, and so the Supreme Court is going to decide that. So that's Monday's case. It's not too exciting, but interesting just because it's a different type of case that you don't see as often. So Tuesday, the theme of the day is the Fourth Amendment and automobiles, automobile searches. The first case is called Byrd v. United States. And the Byrd is a man named Terrence Byrd, who was pulled over on a Pennsylvania highway for driving in the left lane. Byrd was driving a rental car, but the car had been rented by his girlfriend, Latasha Reed, who was not with him when he was pulled over, and Byrd was not listed on the rental agreement as an authorized driver. The police said because he was not an authorized driver of the car, he had no right to no expectation of privacy, and they proceeded to search the car, and in the trunk found body armor and a large quantity of heroin. And Byrd was then arrested and later indicted in federal court for heroin possession with intent to distribute and as a felon in possession of body armor. So Byrd argues that the search was illegal, and basically that the results of the search should be suppressed because the police had no probable cause to search the car. But the police argued that they didn't need probable cause, because, he had no protection from the Fourth Amendment. So the way this fits in Fourth Amendment law is normally the police do need probable cause to search a car. Here the government argues because Byrd is not an authorized driver, it doesn't apply. And really you can look at this case as about, line drawing and where to draw the line. So on one end of the spectrum, we have a car's owner, and it's clear that the owner of a car driving a car who's, you know, pulled over by the police is clearly protected by the Fourth Amendment against a search without a probable cause. But on the other end of the spectrum would be, for example, a thief driving a stolen car. Police who pull someone over driving a stolen car, can search that car without probable cause. And the Fourth Amendment's protections don't apply. So the question is, where does this follow? Where does this fall, on that spectrum? And where do you draw the line between one and the other? So, someone driving a borrowed car with permission of the owner is protected by the Fourth Amendment. But what about Byrd? He had his girlfriend Reed's permission to drive the car, but she was just a renter, not the owner, and the rental company had not authorized him to drive the car. So according to the government, because Byrd was an unauthorized driver, he's on, you know, this kind of spectrum, he's closer to the car thief than the owner's friend, you know, with permission. And they argue that the Fourth Amendment just should not apply in this case to someone who had no authority to be driving the car. So it'll be interesting to see how the court analyzes that case. The second case that they're hearing on Tuesday is Collins v. Virginia. And this is a case about, I'll describe the facts first. The police were searching for a motorcycle that had been involved in high-speed chase. And they had a suspect. They suspected a man named Ryan Collins, as the driver. They found a picture on his Facebook page of a motorcycle covered by a tarp parked next to a house. They identified the house in the picture, which was the residence of Collins' girlfriend, and they went there. At the house, the police walked up the driveway, which went past the front of the house, to the side of the house, and passed a parked car in the driveway and to the back of the driveway where a motorcycle was parked under a tarp. The police officer lifted up the tarp, recorded the license plate and VIN number, and then after checking the VIN number and seeing it had been reported stolen, the officer knocked on the door of the house and arrested Collins, who was later convicted for receiving stolen property. So Collins argues that the police engaged in a illegal search by entering the private driveway and lifting up the tarp. The police, on the other hand, argue that was perfectly constitutional. Now, the case has been framed as kind of a conflict between two different Fourth Amendment rules. The first is that private homes are highly protected under the Fourth Amendment, and except in very limited circumstances that aren't relevant here, police can never enter a house without a search warrant. And what's more, under the Supreme Court's cases, the area immediately surrounding the house, which is referred to as the curtilage, is considered part of the home for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. Collins's argument is this motorcycle was parked on the curtilage, which is a protected area, and the police had no warrant, so they had no right to go in and search it. On the other hand, there's another long line of cases from the Supreme Court that have established something known as the automobile exception to the warrant requirement. And the court has decided that because automobiles are readily mobile and because there's a lesser expectation of privacy in an automobile as compared to a home, when police have probable cause to search, they can search an automobile, and this would include a motorcycle, without first getting a warrant. So they say, under the standard automobile exception to the warrant requirement, they had probable cause to search this motorcycle, and that is to inspect it and look for the VIN number and things like that. And so under the reasons of the standard automobile exception, this was a readily mobile item, and there's no great expectation of privacy compared to a home, so they could go ahead and search it. So the question here is, which of these lines of cases should apply when you have this readily mobile automobile parked in the curtilage of a home? So that's what the Supreme Court will be asked to decide there. And then the final argument day of the week, next week, Wednesday, January 10th, the court only has one case. This is a case called Husted v. Randolph Institute. This is an election law case out of Ohio. And this I'll describe in a moment, but it's a fairly, a politically divisive case. So the way that where this case comes from is states are required under a federal law called the Help America Vote Act. They're required to have processes for cleaning up their voting rolls by removing registered voters who are no longer eligible to vote. Typically, this is because the voters have died or moved or something like that. But the law prohibits removing voters solely by reason of a failure to vote. Under the Ohio law, under one provision of the Ohio law, if a voter hasn't voted in 2 years, they're mailed by the Board of Elections a confirmation notice. If the confirmation notice isn't returned by prepaid mail or otherwise confirmed online, then if the voter doesn't vote or update the registration in the next 4 years, they're removed from the rolls. So first you have a 2 year period of not voting that triggers the mailing of this card. And then the failure to return that card leads to a 4 year period where if you don't vote, then you'll be removed from the rolls. So the challengers to Ohio's process, they argued that basically this directly violates federal law because the entire process leading to the removal from the voting rolls is triggered by someone's failure to vote in an election. But Ohio argues, on the other hand, that the federal law only prohibits removing voters solely by reason of failure to vote, and that's not what's happening here, because the removal only occurs when the voter also fails to respond to a mailed notice, and sending mailed notices is an accepted practice for cleaning up the voter rolls. So that's the basic arguments in the case, but this case it's been framed as part of a larger ongoing battle between the Republicans and Democrats over elections and voting procedures, and including policies like voter ID requirements, which have been enacted by a number of states, and these policies have been typically framed by Republicans as efforts to prevent voter fraud and to ensure the integrity of elections, while Democrats have framed them as efforts to disenfranchise eligible voters, which they allege will disproportionately affect certain Democratic constituencies like minorities and the poor. So this case, while on its face it's about the meaning of this particular federal statute and what it means for something to be solely by reason of a failure to vote, it fits into this larger context between the two political parties. So that's next week's cases. Before I wrap up, I'm going to quickly just mention a few other cases that are coming up later this term. And then we'll wrap up here. One of these cases is Janus v. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And this case, this is a case brought under the First Amendment as a challenge to what's sometimes known as agency fees that's paid by employees who are not a member of a union. It's the fee that a public employee union can charge to employees who choose not to be members of the union. So persons that in a unionized public employees in a unionized workplace have the right to not join the union and to opt out of paying money to the union that would be used for various political purposes by the union. But the union is entitled to still collect a portion of the union dues that would go toward collective bargaining. And the argument is that that otherwise these non-member employees would be free riding on the union's negotiating because they would still benefit from the union's negotiation, which has to be on behalf of all employees, even those who aren't members of the union. And the employees argue that these non-member employees argue that basically they're being compelled to support the union's political speech, and that especially in the public employee context, the even these salary negotiations and union negotiations often involve very politically contentious issues, such as public employee pensions, or, for example, in the education context, things like merit pay for teachers, which has been a highly contentious issue, and that they're basically being forced to financially support a position on these contentious political issues that they don't personally support. So that's the argument on that side. And this is a case, this same issue came to the court previously, but resulted in a 4-4 split with no decision. So this is kind of a repeat issue to the court that now they will presumably be able to decide. The another case that's coming up later this term is called National Institute of Family and Life Advocates v. Becerra. And this is a First Amendment challenge to a California law that requires crisis pregnancy centers. And these are centers that are established by pro-life organizations to provide counseling, generally counseling to pregnant mothers, generally attempting to dissuade people from seeking an abortion or steering them toward options other than abortion. And the California law requires these centers to post information about the availability of abortions. And these this California law has been challenged as again a compelling speech by these pro-life crisis pregnancy centers, compelling them to engage in speech that they say runs directly counter to their mission. And another, one more case, to watch is a case called Benisek v. Limon, which is a partisan gerrymandering case out of, Maryland. And I mentioned earlier, Gill v. Whitford, which was the partisan gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin that was already argued earlier this term. And, the Maryland case is interesting for a few reasons. One, it's politically the flip side of the Wisconsin case, where Wisconsin is a Republican dominated state where the electoral districts were allegedly unconstitutionally gerrymandered to favor the Republicans in an extreme way. Maryland is the other way around, a democratically controlled state where the electoral districts were shaped to favor the Democrats in a very strong way. Another interesting factor about that case is that it's been explicitly framed as a First Amendment challenge. The argument is that by gerrymandering on the basis of political partisan affiliation, the state is discriminating against people on the basis of their political affiliation. In violation of the First Amendment. And so, the Wisconsin case, while the First Amendment issue has been raised there, it's been framed as a more of an equal protection case, which is more typical in the more common racial gerrymandering cases. So it's interesting that the court, you know, while it already has this Wisconsin case, it's also taken up this Maryland case. A lot of people were expecting the court to just hold this Maryland case, not act on it, wait till the decision comes out in Wisconsin, because the decision in the Wisconsin case would, you know, very likely have some impact on the Maryland case, which could then potentially just be sent down to the lower court for re-decision. But instead, they agreed to hear argument in the Maryland case. So that's interesting. You know, there's no, the court doesn't indicate why it takes certain cases or even which justices decided to vote to take the case. It only takes 4 out of the 9 justices to vote to hear a case. So it's hard to, it's just a matter of speculation about what the rationale was for adding this case to the calendar. But, it'll be interesting to see, how that plays out and when the decision in Gill v. Whitford, the Wisconsin case, when that comes down, compared to the, you know, the arguments in this new, Maryland case. So, that brings me to the end of, material I wanted to cover, in today's live stream. As I mentioned at the beginning, I intend to do these live streams on a regular basis, and I'm hoping that, in the future, I will work to publicize these a little more and, have some, live viewers who can, pose questions or comments about the cases I'm discussing in the live stream chat during the live streams, and I will attempt to answer and address those questions and comments during my live stream. So the next scheduled live stream will be a week from today, which, as I recorded it, a week from today is January 11th, and it'll be at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And I intend in next week, I'll, talk about the cases that the court will be hearing on the second week of January's oral arguments. And if, as we're hoping, if, some opinions come down, next week, I hope to describe, kind of summarize and discuss, whatever opinions, if any, get issued next week. And, maybe if anything interesting happens in the oral arguments, on the cases I just, described in this live stream, the cases, up next week, I'll talk about those also. So that's the plan. So, if you're watching this, before January 11th, please join us. If it's after that date, when you're watching this, this archived live stream, please check the Counting to 5 YouTube page and look for the next scheduled live stream. I'm hoping to do these on a pretty regular basis and have an opportunity to ask your questions live and get them answered as you watch. Thank you for watching.
And that brings us to the end of episode 18. Links to resources related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. You can leave comments and questions on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page or YouTube channel, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. You can call and leave questions and comments on the Counting to 5 voicemail line at 774-226-8685. That's 774-2-COUNT-5. Your feedback is important to me. If you aren't already subscribing to Counting to 5, please subscribe now at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find podcasts to make sure you don't miss future episodes. If Counting to 5 isn't available in your favorite podcast app, directory, or service, please let us know and we'll do what we can to get it listed. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to 5.